Hey, Puck Soup listeners, it's Greg. Quick favor to ask. Occasionally, we ask you to fill out some survey stuff so our advertisers can figure out who the lovely people that support this podcast are, and that time has arrived again. We need the help of some great advertisers to support this show. In order to find them, we need to learn a little bit more about you. So go to podsurvey.com/puck-soup. And take a quick anonymous survey that will help us get to know you a little bit better. That way, advertisers can find out how great you are, and we can do awkward ad reads during the show, which I know you're all fans of. Plus, once you've completed the survey, you can choose to enter for a chance to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Ooh, boy. Terms and conditions apply. Again, that's podsurvey.com/puck-soup. That's puck-soup. And thanks for your help, and enjoy the show, scatological as it is.
Sticks and hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to an NFL commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Puck Soup.
I'm Greg Wyshynski of ESPN.
I'm Ryan Lambert from Yahoo.
I'm Sean McAdoo from The Athletic.
And you're in Puck Soup. Apologies if it's a little echoey in here for me. I'll tell you why later. But we have some pressing news to get to first. I don't want this to become a gimmick where we talk about fecal matter at the top of the show each week. But
oh, God.
Oh, boy. I've been very busy. And Lambert, when we were talking about what to talk about on the show this week, and there's plenty to talk about with the trade deadline and John Tavares and all this various and sundry things that we'll get to, mentioned a story that I was frankly tangentially familiar with, but not completely familiar with because I haven't really delved into it. But chat me up, Ryan. What about this guy that ate cat shit and got a job from Dean Blundell?
Well, that's more or less the story.
Wait, who's the guy and why did he eat cat shit?
So the Leafs, I'm trying to remember, this was last Saturday, I want to say. Leafs were down 3-0 in the first period to Montreal. And some guy on Twitter said, hey, if the Leafs win this game, I will eat cat shit out of my litter box, my cat's litter box here. Mm. And the Leafs, of course, came back to win that game. And he did it. And then, like, 2 days later, announced on Facebook, I've been offered a job opportunity by Dean Blundell to work on his morning show.
I did see references to, is cat shit guy the new dart guy? So now I understand that the guy who painted his whole head blue and his gimmick was smoking a cigarette in the arena, he got a radio job, and now the guy who ate cat shit also got a radio job. So my question to you, Sean, is why don't you have a radio job?
I think the question that a lot of us are asking ourselves. I mean, it's if anybody is listening to this and you're saying, wait a second, who is Dean Blundell? Because I'm guessing if you're outside of the Toronto market, you may not be familiar with his work. Picture a guy who would hire someone who ate cat shit. That's it. You got it. That's the guy. So I think my understanding of this, and I haven't followed the story super deeply, so Ryan can correct me if I'm wrong. I think when we talk about this guy getting offered a job, like, it's not like he's getting paid to go and be on the radio and this is his new career. Like, I think it's more like he's going to be on the show, you know, once a week or whatever to, I don't know. I can't even imagine what they're going to have him do.
Well, yeah, to use it in radio parlance, he's the stunt boy. The guy who comes in to be the stunt boy.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like they're basically going to bring him in and make fun of him. And then eventually when it's not funny anymore, which will probably take about 2 weeks, that might be the end of that. I think he said in his Facebook post, he's not like quitting his job to go and pursue a career in radio. He's
a lucrative career of catching.
I mean, I guess he's a fan who has, through weird circumstances, been given an opportunity he wouldn't otherwise get and has decided to grab it and run with it for as long as that lasts. And I guess in some sense, good for him. But my only... The only good part of this is and I'm sure we'll get to this other part later, but the fact that this happened the same week as that terrible New York Islander fan video is really like settling down Leaf fans, because you know they would have been coming with like the full mockery, and instead they've had to like dial it down to like 98% mockery because one of them ate cat poop and got a job out of
right.
it. So it takes a little bit of the sting off of the pointing and laughing at the worst of the other fan base.
Now, if were I Dean Blundell, I'd be on my 15th radio job, but that's besides the point. I would probably do one of two things with this guy. I would obviously do a taste test. But the question is, do I do a taste test of what did this cat last eat? Or would I do a taste test of from what breed of cat did this come from? What has the better potential, Ryan?
You know, if you're the kind of connoisseur who can tell the difference between, like, a Persian and a tabby, that way,
sort of
I don't know.
A cat shit sommelier, if
yeah,
you will.
Yeah, that I think is maybe asking too much.
Mm-hmm.
I think that maybe the other way to go with it is better, but, you know, I don't know what this guy's background is. Maybe he is just that damn good. He's the Connor McDavid of eating cat shit. I don't know.
Well, now at least we know what's going to be on his business card. Please, Hockey World, give us a break for the next episode. Don't do anything. No, coaches, don't talk about your players shitting themselves. Fans, don't eat shit. I mean, the Colorado fans that are always mad at me can eat shit, but like everybody else, don't eat shit. And then maybe we can not have to do this off the top of every show.
Why are Colorado fans mad at you?
Colorado fans are always sour at me for two reasons. One, because I had the nerve to say that their goaltending was in the bottom third of the league, which it is this year.
Yeah.
And then because it was really quite good for a while, and then they all came back and like pissed all over that prediction. And they're also one of those weird fan bases, because I'm outward about being a Devils fan, that believes that whenever I'm critical of the team, it tracks back to them beating the Devils in 2001.
Sure.
And, like, I have no anger towards the Colorado Avalanche for 2001. I have anger towards Ray Bourque and the goddamn fucking pity party around Ray Bourque and Gary Thorne, my favorite announcer, going, Ray Bourque! You know, and all that. And exit 16W, the exit that I took to go to the Meadowlands to watch my favorite team, ended up becoming a fucking meme for the other team because they needed 16 wins to win the cup. I hate that, but I harbor no ill will towards the Colorado Avalanche.
Sounds like you got some ill will and you're jealous.
Towards Ray Bourque and that specific slice of the Avalanche, but how could I hate Gabriel Landeskog, who shot a video in which he masturbated in front of a mirror while listening to Imagine Dragons? How could I hate Nathan MacKinnon, who is finally blossoming into the player we all believed he could be? How could I hate Mikko Rantanen, who probably is going to sign an offer sheet this summer with another team and really make things interesting for me? How could I hate any of those people? Exactly.
Yeah.
So we made some do you have the deadline wagers in front of you, by the way, Sean?
Yeah.
Okay, so the trade deadline was Monday. It was fantastic. Me and Emily sat in a big conference room with our bosses. We ate sandwiches for 5 hours and then worked for about 15 minutes. It was a great day. And there was some cool shit that happened, but we made some predictions last week about what we thought would happen, and many of them I think were wrong.
Yes. So well, you know what? You guys did okay. So let's run them down.
Okay.
The first one I gave you is the over-under on the total trades. And I had two here. I had 29.5 for the week leading up to the deadline and 19.5 on deadline day. I can't remember which one I gave you guys or if it was both. But Greg, you bet over. Ryan, you bet under. And they both came in over. There were 23 trades on deadline day, and there were 32 in the time between our last podcast and the end of the deadline. So
I would like to thank the Winnipeg Jets for getting me the over.
Yeah. Exactly.
Stupid chill day off.
And you know what? Let's even skip to that one, because that was one of them, was the Canadian team to make the most trades, and the heavy favorite that Ryan backed was the Ottawa Senators, who we had at 3-2. But Greg pulled the long shot bet at 18-1. He went with the Winnipeg Jets.
Wow.
Look at that shit. Oh, my God.
Actually pulled it off because Kevin Cheveldayoff, like a kid from a repressed family who, like, finally gets to go off on his own
Yeah,
and
right.
try his first beer and suddenly is just drunk with the joy of pulling off trades, was just randomly trading guys like well even past 3 o'clock. They're like 3:30 and you're still hearing about the Jets trading some guy you've never heard of for some other guy. And I like to imagine that they had to like tackle Kevin Cheveldayoff and drag him away from his phone to get him to stop making trades, because the Winnipeg Jets made 6 trades. Yeah, the Senators made 4, which is a lot. That would put them, I think, in the top 5. But the Winnipeg Jets were just like not letting anyone else come up for air.
So it's like NHL Central Registry.
Me, Kevin Cheveldayoff.
Oh, again. sir, we have 17 of your trades in our fax machine right now. Give us a moment.
They mentioned on Twitter, somebody mentioned that it might be an NHL rule that the maximum number of transactions you can make in a day is 6. And that might be the only thing that stopped Kevin Cheveldayoff from trading 15, 16 more guys.
That was impressive.
Sean, you bring up a good point, though, because it's funny like how quickly history can change. Like, there was a time when he was the poster boy for not
no
making
trade.
A deal.
Like, yeah.
Tyler Myers deal was the first player-for-player trade, yes. I think he made, right,
as GM. He went, like, literally years to the point where there were, you know, people questioning and went years on a team that was kind of underachieving compared to expectations quite a lot. So, you know, there were articles written like what is Kevin Cheveldayoff's actual job if he's never making player for player trades? And then he made the Tyler Myers Evander Kane one, which was a big one, and then he kind of stopped again, but now he's all grown up. He's the I mean, I don't know how many of these trades were actually player for player trades. Some of them were just those random, you know, shuffling around, but every trade counts. We do not judge trades here.
If they traded for Kevin Hayes to be a third line center and not expect him to hit anybody, he's going to be fine there. But I kind of like Brian Little a little bit as a second line center for that team.
I'm surprised. I feel like maybe Ryan can talk me into Kevin Hayes
as Kevin Hayes.
Since he's a college guy, because I've never really felt like he was a sort of impact type of guy that you trade a first round pick and
it's always seemed to me to be the gentleman's Nick Bjugstad.
Yeah, and like Nick Bjugstad's good though. Like he's a high end second line center. And Winnipeg, you know, I also think Brian Little's very good and kind of, you know, I don't want to say underrated because I think everybody kind of rates him more or less properly, but like he's a well regarded player, and so if you can go get another one of those for what's going to be the 23rd pick in the draft and a guy you don't really need in Brendan Lemieux, like, that's fine.
Yeah, okay, that's it. I thought it was a good haul for the Rangers I thought they did well. And speaking of which, that can take us into our next one, because we also did the American team that would have the most trades between now and the deadline, and the Rangers were our favorites at 5-1. Narrowly ahead of Detroit at 6-1. Ryan, you did take the Rangers, backing the favorite again. Greg, you took the Minnesota Wild, who we had at 10-1. The Rangers made 3 trades. The Wild made 2, I think, because
they got
all theirs out of the way early.
Yeah.
But the team that kind of came out of nowhere and to blow away the field at 12-1, making 6 trades, was the Florida Panthers.
Whoa, like Randy Orton, an RKO out of nowhere.
That's right.
Yeah, and including, by the way, I'm not saying that the Florida Panthers listened to this podcast and set out intentionally to win this bet, but their total of 6 includes those 2 trades that they made with the Carolina Hurricanes, where they traded a player for future considerations and then immediately minutes later traded another player going the other way. That's one trade. What are we doing?
I've got a theory. And it's that Don Waddell did the future considerations dance because he didn't want the Jeff Skinner trade to now be Jeff Skinner for Thomas Yurko. To actually knock it down a peg from Cliff Pugh.
Okay.
That's my theory.
That's you know what? That's as good a theory as any, because that was I would love to find out.
I like your theory too, that the computer boys are all listening to this podcast while they're typing away on their computers.
That's better than my theory, because I've always, like, when I was a kid, and I'm sure this is not something you could actually do, but my dream was always to see it like a deadline deal of future considerations for future considerations, and then they just fill in the future considerations later and make the trade that way, like right before the playoffs. The Panthers are like, here, you take this guy, like, Mike Hoffman.
Why in an era in which teams are trading away fifth round picks in 2022 do we even need future considerations? Like,
I don't understand.
Trade a seventh in 2027 and just call it a day.
And you should have to reveal what the future considerations are, because A, fans want to know, and B, it's extra funny when it turns out the future considerations are nothing and you're just giving the player away. So, yeah, congratulations to the Florida Panthers for pulling off the upset there. Couple of the other bets we said over under on first round picks traded between now and the deadline, and we said
this was a good one.
We said that would include conditional first round picks as long as they were announced as conditional firsts, and that turned out to be important because you both bet the over was 2.5, and the over came in for you based on two first round picks being traded and two more conditional picks. The Duchesne trade had 1-1. There was the Kevin Hayes, and then the Brandon Montour trade came in as a first round pick. So we had four there. Bet number three. This one's kind of interesting. The over under for the biggest trade, total players and picks, including conditional picks. I set the over under at 5.5. You both bet the over. Mm-hmm. You both win that bet, but barely, because of all the 32 trades, there was one trade that had six. And that was the Matt Duchesne trade, and that included a conditional pick that may or may not actually play. So it was, compared to previous years where there were big trades with like 6, 7, 8 assets, this one was actually pretty low.
Which is weird. You know what the weirdest thing about the Duchesne, and we'll get to Ottawa in a second, like, I really thought that they were going to take on more salary coming back the other way. That's why I thought that whatever trade Duchesne was involved in would have been like seven players, because they would have taken some bullshit contract back the other way.
Yeah, they didn't take a dime back. That's wild to me. Because they're going to have to spend, what, $25 million just to get to the cap floor?
To get to the floor.
Just to hit the floor, they've got a ton, which is interesting because it opens the opportunity to do all sorts of neat stuff, either taking bad contracts or even laundering bad contracts, where, you know, we all know you can only keep 50%. There's some guys out there like Milan Lucic, even with the Oilers retaining 50%, I don't think there's a lot of teams lining up to pay him a $3 million cap hit. But is there a team out there that would pay him a $1.5 million cap hit? You know, now maybe you're getting into that zone. So if the Oilers retain and then the Senators retain and then they flip him somewhere else, or Louis Erickson, or guys like that, it puts them in an interesting position to do it. I'm curious to see if that's actually what the Senators will do, and whether they'll like create this misfit toys type of roster where they, have all these guys that were buyout candidates for other teams, or if they just do the more predictable thing and spend way too much money on certain free agents that have character and whatever else.
The problem is that like anybody you'd think about buying out, like that, or not buying out, but like trading as a salary dump or whatever, almost all of them have some sort of no trade, no move protection. Like, because I was looking at it when I wrote about like, oh, this is what the Senators should do since they're going to trade everybody and spend a ton of money. And I was like, oh, no, Backes, Lucci, like just go down the list of 90% of them. And
if you're Milan Lucic, would you not at least think about going anywhere that's not Edmonton where you're going to play and have a chance? I mean, you come to Ottawa, obviously it's an awful situation. You're not going to be anywhere near the playoffs, but you're going to be playing on potentially the first line. It's if you want to play 15 minutes a night, like that's kind of your option. Or do you want to stay in Edmonton and be the whipping boy? Or do you want to get traded somewhere else and be the healthy scratch who gets bought out? I don't know.
Do you want to stay in Edmonton with that lottery ticket called Connor McDavid and hope to God they get that thing figured out, and then all of a sudden you're on a winning team and you don't have to worry about being on a shitty team?
The only way they're going to get it figured out is by bringing in other players around him, at which point everyone points at your contract constantly, and you become like what David Clarkson was in Toronto, where it's just unworkable, because even though all you did was sign the contract they put in front of you, you're now the villain, because you're the one screwing up the salary cap. So,
right.
I don't know. I obviously there's a lot there's a lot of factors you think about, but I'm not completely convinced that nobody would waive a no trade to come to Ottawa, if only because the opportunity here to get ice time is going to be tremendous, because they don't have any players for the next couple of years.
What I'm most interested in is if Pierre Dorion will treat each salary dump with the same puppy dog enthusiasm that he does every transaction. Like when the Coyotes do it, Chayka's like, yeah, we're totally just getting Marian Hossa's cap space. Like when Ottawa does it, are we going to have to see the same thing with like the Alex Burrows trade, where he's like, I just went to our locker room and like literally everybody said, Lucic, really, Pierre? That is incredible. Like nobody talked about the cap hit or anything. Yeah. They're all just like, they love it. People were throwing candy and sweets at me. It was the proudest day that Ottawa has ever had with this trade.
That was actually really interesting to me, because I understand that right now where the Senators are at, you need to work some PR spin. But, I mean, he came as close as I've ever heard a GM lately come to saying outright, I won this trade. Like, I can't believe – he was so excited.
Are you talking about the Burrows trade or this deadline?
No, the Mark Stone, the Eric Brand, like getting Eric Brandstrom. Like, he was was selling that so hard that he walked right up to the line of saying, like, I can't believe the Golden Knights gave this guy up. We totally ripped them off to get him. He didn't go quite that far, but, you know, usually – in a league where GMs usually bend over backwards to never suggest that they've done well on a trade because they don't want to seem like they're burning a colleague, he was really going over the top on the not completely genuine enthusiasm.
While we're talking about it, we might as well go down that path now. I think he did really well for having three assets that totally weren't going to stay and had to get something for them. I mean, obviously, he pulled Brandstrom out of that deal, and that's an incredible player to add, but the best young player traded on deadline day. I thought he did okay in Columbus, including getting the conditional first if he signs there. Like, I thought for being against the wall and not exactly being terrific at his job, like, the bar for me was set, don't get fleeced. And he didn't get fleeced. Yeah. And I actually think he did pretty good overall.
He certainly did better than he did on the Eric Carlson trade, which was...
Right, so he kind of had a weird advantage here where they clearly Columbus needed to like push all in to barely make the playoffs, if they make it at all, to, I don't know, save somebody's job probably. And so they were just like, oh yeah, we'll take whoever you got. That's great. That's awesome. We'll just give you whatever you want. And then, you know, they had an asset in Mark Stone where, what, four or five teams were probably like, yeah, we're very interested in acquiring this player. So that's really like he just happened to find a sucker in Columbus, basically, and have an asset everybody rightly wanted.
Yeah. The key with the Duchesne deal is that conditional pick, because if that is a little bit tough for the Senators because it's out of their control. You know, if Matt Duchesne doesn't want to sign in Columbus, or if Columbus decides they don't want to, or if they miss the playoffs and they have a change in the front office and they, you know, that doesn't happen, then I think the return on Matt Duchesne is probably looked back on as being not especially great. Although, you know, obviously if they miss the playoffs, the first round pick from this year will be much nicer than they were expected. But I can see a scenario where Panarin leaves, Bobrovsky leaves, the Blue Jackets feel like they have to keep Matt Duchesne. They sign him, the Senators get that 2020, and then the Blue Jackets aren't very good. And suddenly, once again, we have a situation where Matt Duchesne has been traded for a future first-round pick that a team might really regret giving up. I'm not suggesting next year's Blue Jackets are going to be this year's Senators, where they're finishing dead last. But they could be a lottery team, absolutely. And how ironic would that be if after all of this in 2020, the Senators end up winning the lottery with a pick they acquire for Matt Duchesne,
right?
And using that as a key piece of their rebuild. I think that would be a hell of a way to end
like,
this story.
And like we mentioned, I mean, the part that you're forgetting is that Matt Duchesne's also a plague inflicted on teams where they have to rebuild as soon as he gets there.
Absolutely. So. I think is the interesting piece to me. And the other thing that I thought was pretty fascinating, I don't know if you guys saw this, but Pierre LeBrun had a sort of a behind the scenes of how the Mark Stone deal went down. And according to him, like it literally went down to the final minutes, and it was, I think he had it that the Knights and the Senators didn't agree on the trade until 2:15, mm-hmm. so 45 minutes before the deadline. And the Knights' agreement was conditional on them having a contract with Mark Stone, and they hadn't talked to him yet. So with 45 minutes to go, they call up Mark Stone and start exchanging numbers, and apparently, like live on the phone, are working back and forth on putting a deal together, and that it comes back like 15 minutes before the deadline that they've got a deal, and okay, so the trade goes through, and Pierre kind of suspects, I don't think he is necessarily reporting, but he suspects that there must have been a plan B for the Senators, and the fact that the Nashville Predators didn't make the Wayne Simmonds deal until like 3 minutes before the deadline would suggest that maybe they were plan B, that were if Mark Stone wouldn't agree to a long-term deal with the Knights were going to back out, and Stone was going to go to the Predators as a rental.
It's interesting. The interesting thing too, like Ryan, you mentioned like him lucking into Columbus as an overcompensating trade partner. Like Vegas is very much that too. Like Vegas is spending like a drunken sailor in Vegas. Like the Tatar trade last year was stupid. This one is probably a little bit of overcompensation, but even if it's not, like they're dealing from such a stacked deck because they have so many picks and so many prospects from being the team that they are, that I feel like other teams weren't necessarily going to ante up with the same package for Stone, and that's probably why they won the day. And it's a good deal. Like I was a little surprised they turned around and signed him so quickly. But that's a pretty stout top six for them in the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, I said it on Twitter and got a decent amount of guff for it, but I think that can be one of the like maybe the best top six in the league if things go well. I know like the guys who were on the top line last year aren't having the same kind of success because Bill Carlson's not shooting 28% anymore, but like. Those guys are still awesome, and if they're your second line now because you have Stastny, Pacioretty, and Stone as your top line, I don't know, you know, maybe Toronto, and then, you know, I guess it depends on what happens with Tampa this summer.
To put a cherry on it for this trade, like, it just goes to show you that as much heat as people get in their, like, personal relationships, it's all business at the end of the day. I heard from multiple people that George McPhee was hella pissed at Pierre Dorion last year after the Erik Karlsson debacle at the trade deadline, like to the point of like just being fucking fuming about it. And so they do business again a year later. And I just find that to be kind of interesting because the league is so populated with people that just seem to make trades with their friends, Paul Finn. And it's interesting to see two guys that had some heat kind of revisiting that relationship a year later in almost the same situation and getting a deal done. Sean, you wanted to talk about the Senators arena situation too.
Well, I mean, we should just touch on it because I don't think it was a big surprise, but we got the news yesterday that basically it's fallen through. There had been an extension for Eugene Melnyk to work out his differences with the partners on the project. And he did not, and he, you know, the mayor of Ottawa yesterday had pretty much laid the blame for this whole project falling apart at the feet of Eugene Melnyk, and now nobody's quite sure where it goes. Maybe somebody else gets to come in and build the arena, and that'll obviously give them leverage over the Senators as far as potentially owning the team at some point or working out some sort of agreement. But it was already a pretty miserable week to be a Senators fan. This was kind of just the cherry on top that even this arena that is presumably a key part of the way that Eugene Melnyk is going to spend the salary cap for 5 straight years, like he promised. Now it
near
doesn't,
the salary cap. He didn't say two.
Yeah, near.
He said
yes,
near.
Right. Near.
Spend anywhere near the salary cap.
You're essentially saying that if the arena gets built, it's going to be built by somebody who would like bend over the Senators on terms. They won't own their own building, which is the whole point of this thing.
Well, it's possible. I mean, that's one way this could go. I mean, this is, you know, it's We're talking big business, big egos. It's always possible they could turn around tomorrow and say, okay, we're back and we're ready to work again. But there've been a lot of bridges burned, and yeah, this is the point where somebody else I think might step in, because the city still has this land. They still want to get this project built, presumably including an NHL ready arena. And you know, could you have a situation where someone else comes in and builds it, and then it's just sitting there waiting for a tenant? It could all become a mess. Or if you're a Senators fan, it could become the pressure point that forces Eugene Melnyk to sell the team to this other group, and then everyone's happy and God things willing. Are wonderful. We'll see.
So in short term, they'll still be in Kanata. They're going to be pretty bad next year. I'm going to guess tickets are available. And if you want to get Senators tickets next year, or tickets to any sport or concert, you better use SeatGeek. Was that better, Ryan? Did it make you feel better on that transition?
That was good, yeah.
Okay, good. Getting tickets online can be far too complicated. With hundreds of sites and varying levels of reliability, it's hard to know hubba, 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 money, 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 who do you trust? That's why SeatGeek is the way to go. SeatGeek pulls millions of tickets into one place, so you can easily find the seats you want for a price you're willing to pay. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Make SeatGeek your go-to source for everything from sports and concerts to comedy and theater tickets. We've talked about it many times on the show that I am enamored with the big green circles of SeatGeek. You go to the site or the app, you check it out. The bigger and deeper the green and the larger the circle, the better the deal is going to be for you. And that makes buying this stuff easy for idiots like me. I've got the SeatGeek app on my phone, so should you. And best of all, listeners to Puck Soup get $10 off their first SeatGeek purchase. That's $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Download the SeatGeek app today. Enter the promo code SOUP. That's S-O-U-P. That spells soup. That's promo code SOUP for $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. SeatGeek, life's an event. We have the tickets. Where are we now in the bets? We have more bets to talk about.
We've got two more. We'll finish off the last two. Bet number six, this ended up being kind of a dud. It was how many goalies who played in the NHL this year would be traded between now and the deadline. We set the over-under at 3.5 and ended up being one. Kincaid was the only one. You guys both bet the under, so you both win.
Yeah, because the Cam Talbot deal happened like way early.
That had already been done, and you know we had the over-under a little high because typically when a goalie gets traded in the NHL, there's another goalie coming back, but that wasn't even the case here. And when that trade first happened, it kind of felt like you know, with him going to Columbus, like, was this possibly setting up something bigger, or, you know, was it a first domino? But it turned out it wasn't. It was just New Jersey clearing the roster
spot. I'm
still
really surprised the Sharks didn't add something in goal.
Yeah,
and maybe the prices were too high on, like, a Jimmy Howard, or maybe they just didn't want to move him or whatever.
But I think Howard refused to waive his no trade, I think, is what I saw.
All right, well, that makes sense.
That would make sense, because that was the most confusing.
That could have made him better.
That was the most confusing one to not get traded was Jimmy Howard. I really couldn't figure out why Detroit wouldn't work a move there. But yeah, if it's a no trade situation, then
if he's on the Red Wings, he has a no trade.
That's right. And then there was that weird Ryan Miller is going to the Sharks, but then he didn't thing that happened because who knows? Like, I don't feel like it was a thing of like a fake account or anything like that. Like, a legitimate account said it was going to happen, and then it didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
John Hovind, Mayor's Manor, who's got good info, said was the one who reported it. And, you know, sometimes you eat the bar, and sometimes the bar eats you when it comes to trade rumors and such, because, you know, information comes at you from different places, and sometimes it's just bad info. All right, what was the last bet there?
Last one was, this one ended up being kind of interesting. It was between now and the deadline, how many trades will be made involving a player who has been an all-star? Ooh. We set the over-under at 3.5. You guys both bet over. It came under. There were only two players, by my count, who have been all-stars, and that's Matt Duchene and Wayne Simmonds. Those are the only two guys that were traded. Mark Stone has not been an all-star. Neither is Matt Zuccarello. And all the other guys, Panarin, Jimmy Howard, Jeff Carter, you know, on down the list, Thomas Vanek didn't get traded. So there was that is one that usually ends up being a sneaky over, and it ended up being a big under this time around.
And future considerations was never an all-star?
I don't think so. Not yet.
Okay, because we would have hit the over on that one.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff. Now, favorite trade for all three of us of the deadline? I think mine's probably the San Jose Sharks Gustav Nyquist trade. I often look at the Sharks roster and say to myself, okay, those are two great lines. It'd be nice if Joe Thornton had one more piece to play with on the third line. And now he does. And I thought the cost was pretty good. I thought making that deal before the actual deadline day was smart. And I kind of dig that move. I think that, that puts them squarely on the same level as your Nashvilles and your Winnipegs and your Calgarys as far as depth of offense. They were already fifth in the league in scoring. I think that was my favorite move of the day.
My favorite, it's not necessarily one I would rank as the best trade or the biggest impact, but just as I was really fascinated by the Predators in the Wild and the Granlund and Gallagher trade, because that is as close as we came to like a legitimate hockey trade, where it's two guys of roughly the same age, roughly the same sort of player, kind of, where it was just kind of two teams that seemed like they were betting that the other team's guy was better than their guy. And I did, when it first came through, I was really kind of scratching my head wondering what the Wild were doing, and I felt like the Predators had kind of maybe stolen something here, and I've seen some arguments that it might be closer than you think, but I do find that really interesting, especially since it's a new GM trading with the mother of all veteran GMs, and I just found that real interesting. No picks, no salary considerations, really just two teams swapping guys at roughly the same stage of their career and betting that their new guy's going to be better than the old guy.
Yeah, I kind of saw it more as a Charlie Coyle for Ryan Donato type trade, where Kevin Fiala, I'm trying to remember, I think he's like 21, 22. And Michael Granlund's like 25, 26, something like that. And it was just, speeding up the process, because Kevin Fiala, if he ever becomes what everybody thinks he's going to become, will be roughly as good as Michael Granlund, and the Predators didn't necessarily want to wait around and find out. Mm-hmm. They'd just rather have Michael Granlund.
Yeah, I mean, he's 22, so I'm saying the same ballpark, but you're right. I mean, 4 years in today's NHL is a gap.
Well, it's still going up the aging curve versus being at the peak of it, right? Like 26 is about when guys stop improving, so we have a pretty good idea of this. Okay, we know who Michael Granlund is. We don't quite know who Kevin Fiala is, and I feel like probably he was a little disappointing for Nashville this year. And
this year, 23 goals last year, but just 10 this year. But it's interesting, because when you're Paul Fenton and you've got a team like Minnesota that's disappointing and kind of on the older side, you don't necessarily think that the guys that you're going to be trading away are going to be the 26-year-olds. But I guess if there's no market for the 30-something-year-olds, or the guys that there might be a market for, like Eric Staal, don't want to go, you're kind of left to either stay the course or make bigger moves that might involve guys that wouldn't have been your first choice.
The most fascinating thing about the Wild trades were the clear psychological damage the Niederreiter for Victor Rask trade has caused amongst Wild fans. Like, Paul Fenton can't do shit right now without somebody in Minnesota being like, this is horrible. This guy can't even manage to close the bathroom door, let alone manage to make a trade. And, like, it is incredible to see how one bad deal, and it is a fucking terrible deal, let's be honest.
Really bad.
Has completely poisoned the well. It's like, it's like when the pilot episode of a sitcom comes on the air and people hate it, and then the show is canceled within eight episodes because no one gave it a second chance. It's like that one trade has now cemented Paul Fenton as a bumbling fool in the eyes of Minnesota fans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it was one of those trades where the second it was made, everybody who is smart about this kind of thing was like, wait, what? Hold on. Yeah. Victor Rask, the Hurricanes guy who stinks.
That trade was like the Buff Bagwell debut on Monday Night Raw of NHL hockey trades. Like, just immediately everyone was like, no, not, that's it. Scrap the entire thing. We're done.
Yeah, Paul Fenton crashed through a wall wearing a glittery stormtrooper mask and fell in front of Sting.
That's it. So there we go. That's that closes off the bet. So Greg, you won. Between your
great
Winnipeg long shot, and I think there was the only one where you guys actually were on different sides on the over under. You hit the over. So you
well,
win.
There you go.
And you are now flush with imaginary.
I'd like to thank the Academy. You know, movies are where dreams take flight, and I would like to read 70,000 names off this piece of loose leaf paper as the orchestra plays.
Everybody at CAA.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Before we get to our guest this week, there was a notable fight in the NHL. Notable because there are no more fights. Also notable because it was a fight that involved Zdeno Chara. I'm often asked who the toughest person in the NHL is, or the most intimidating, or whatever. It's always Chara. It's never not going to be Chara. Chara doesn't need to fight because no one wants to fight him because he could end you. And yep. So to see Evander Kane step up and try to take him on and jump him, basically, and get a few licks in before Chara took over and tried to end him was interesting. But what were your thoughts on that whole kerfuffle? I actually thought the league got it right, that Chara was trying to hit through him, got contact with the head because Evander Kane's head was sort of prone and, you know, wasn't looking to pick the head or anything like that. It's just there's a 7-inch difference between the two guys, and that's just going to happen when Kane's kind of bent over. But at the same time, I'm also, like, kind of feeling for Evander Kane because he knows he just got hit in the head. He looks over at the referee. He's just standing there. And so he's like, all right, I'll just take on this man mountain. I give him credit for having the cojones to do it.
Yeah. I think I'm with you. I was not shocked that it wasn't a suspension. I mean, we can argue all day whether the league should factor in size differences on this stuff, but they do.
Mm-hmm. Size matters.
Yeah,
as they say.
That's what I've heard. So it ends up being a thing where, you know, if Evander Kane obviously wasn't happy, and you know, you look at his Twitter feed, whatever he tweeted out, like the three blind mice or whatever it was. I gotta say, the one thing that really, and I had a weird experience, and this is partly because I've been sick for the last week, and my brain is doing weird things and going in weird places. But when I first watched the clip of the Evander Kane Zdeno Chara fight, I was briefly convinced that somebody, as a joke, had swapped in audio from a different fight of Jack Edwards on top of that fight. Because what Jack Edwards was yelling did not seem to have any resemblance. Like, right. If you just listen to the audio, you would think that he was witnessing a murder. Like, the most one-sided fight. He's yelling, like, oh, he's feeding him. He's just destroyed. Have you had enough?
Zdeno Chara taking the life out of this man.
Yeah,
one swipe after
about, like,
another. Shaking him with a scalpel at his side like they were in prison.
Like, and meanwhile, Zdeno Chara is landing like three punches and the fight's over. Like, that,
yeah,
and he won the fight.
Those
like,
fights where both guys are just like holding each other at an arm's length and one guy's trying to come over top, like, with his whole body.
Right.
Which you can do if you're Zdeno Chara, obviously.
Exactly. And I'm sure it's not fun. Like, I'm sure if Zdeno Chara punched me in the back of the head once like that, my head would explode into like a fine mist.
Yeah.
But, you know, my God, like, is there so little fighting in the league now that, like, Jack Edwards has just forgotten what an actual one-sided fight looks like and has to...
In 1976, a brave group of farmers rose up and took on the British Imperial Army. In 2019, a brave 6'9" Slovakian rose up and took on the insurgency from San Jose.
That's it. That was exactly it.
That's
so, yeah, if you haven't seen the fight, definitely go and get it with that audio and see if you can piece
that
together.
Audio. But I'm impressed because I just checked this. I didn't check it the other day. If you put blind mice into the GIF search on Twitter, it is at least one of the first six returns is the blind mice GIF that he used. So the notion of an NHL player entering in blind mice into the GIF locator on Twitter and then using that function really warms my heart. And I give him kudos for doing it. And he probably didn't get fined either, which is interesting.
I don't know if he did. Yeah.
I think in a situation like that, everybody was just kind of like, yeah, we see where he's coming from with this one.
You got hit in the head.
Yeah, it really is a thing where
he
got hit in the head
and tried to murder him.
and, and, And then he was, like, really mad about it, and everybody's like, well, we're going to find him after Zdeno Chara caves his face in? Like, well, that's fine. Like, you're
NHL headquarters are like, they're like, what do you think, Coley? Oh, we'll let this one go. The boy's been through enough.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's it. That's right. It. You got hit in the head by Zdeno Chara and then punched in the back of the head three or four times while Jack Edwards yelled about how you were being destroyed. I think, yeah, you get one free Twitter gif.
Dig a grave for him and get a teal casket because Evander Kane has been ended. If you're a fan of the Philadelphia Flyers, the Chicago Blackhawks, the Calgary Flames, the Phoenix Coyotes, the Edmonton Oilers, the San Jose Sharks, the Chicago Wolves, Cloten HC, or the Belfast Giants of the Elite Ice Hockey League, you are going to know our next guest, Jim Vandermeer. Well-known journeyman in the NHL, a defenseman, tall, you know, a tall drink of water, whatever. Not really that tall. I'm actually taller than him. He is now playing hockey in the UK and has been for the last several years. He's become kind of a cult icon there as a guy who drops the gloves now and again. And he's got kind of an interesting story about his path there. He tells some tales about his time in the NHL. And also we discuss what it's like playing in Northern Ireland during the time of Brexit. And is it like here where you can't go anywhere without someone saying, Trump, can you go get a coffee and not hear something about Brexit? So it's a good chat with him. I think you'll dig this one. It's kind of a different interview than what we normally do. Here's Jim. All right. Jim Vandermeer is a defenseman for the Belfast Giants of the Elite Ice Hockey League. It's, you know, it's funny. Like, when I first started writing about this league, I totally thought it was the English Ice Hockey League just because that's how it should seem like it should be. But I enjoy the hubris of it being elite. It's pretty good.
No, for sure. I actually played here for 2 months before I thought it was the English Ice Hockey League. That's what I thought it was as well. So
I don't feel so bad then.
A little bit. When I came back, I came here for like 2 months the first time I got here, and that's honestly what I thought it was called too. So
that's awesome. All right, so for those that don't know, so Jim played in the NHL here and there on and off from 2002 all the way through 2012, and then you were in the AHL 2012-13. Then you went to Switzerland, and then you went to the Belfast Giants from 2015 to now. What brought you from the Swiss League to Belfast?
It's kind of weird. I actually had an extra year left on my deal in Cloten in the Swiss League and got bought out. But there it's kind of like a negotiation process, and it took forever to get that kind of sorted out. And by the time that was done, most European leagues had all their imports signed, and so I was just kind of waiting for either somebody to get hurt or play bad enough that they fired him. So... And that just, nothing really came along that I really liked. And then it was about February, so I hadn't played in almost a year. I was, you know, skating back in Vancouver, but nothing real serious. And then the guy I played against in Switzerland, and a guy my wife used to babysit, and were calling me saying they needed a D-man in Belfast, so I made a couple calls with guys I knew that had played for Belfast before, and they all said good things. So I figured I'd go check it out for a couple months and go from there.
All right, so hold on, pause for a second. So your wife babysits a kid who grows up to be a hockey player, and then the hockey player is like, we need a defenseman? Dude, my ex-babysitter's husband is a totally great defenseman. Like, is that basically how it plays out?
Yeah, that's kind of how it worked out. Even though I had known him for a bit, but that's kind of sort of how it went, yeah. But Derek Walzer was the coach here at the time. I played against him in Switzerland and played with him at Spengler Cup. And so I had known him just, you know, the year prior, so... Yeah, it was a pretty quick conversation, and
pretty great.
I didn't have any real good options at the time, so figured I'd check it out. And you know, they do a really good schooling program here, so figured I'd go back to school and get a business degree. And
oh, cool! What did you know about Belfast before going there? Did you know anything about it?
I honestly didn't know a whole lot. I knew a couple guys that had played there, and they said they really enjoyed their time. I honestly didn't know a lot about the history of the city or the troubles or anything like that. And you know, coming here has kind of opened my eyes to kind of what this area has been, kind of what they've gone through the last 30, 40 years. So.
Yeah, right. Cool. Jesus. You got a lot of catching up to do when you're in Belfast as far as like what the history has been like there, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Tell me what the hockey culture is there like, because in my time covering the Belfast Giants and the Sheffield Steelers and all those elite hockey league teams, like it kind of reminded me of some of the small market teams back in the States. Like you have this really passionate following. Maybe not the biggest, but the people that are into it are really into it. Would that be the right way to characterize it?
I think that's very, very accurate. You know, we have a great set of fans here in Belfast, and like I said, they're really, really passionate. They've been following the team's been here for 20 years now, so it's not like they're totally new to hockey. You know, obviously, lots of people are new to hockey every day, but the core following here is very passionate and they're nuts about it.
What's it like living there? Like you're from Canada, I believe, right? That accurate, I think. Was there a big adjustment to being in Belfast, or is it just sort of just like kind of comparable to being a North American city in some ways?
Yeah, it's pretty comparable. There's some things you think if you're a little bit of a time warp back in time, but I think for the most part it's exactly the same, other than driving on the other side of the road. DVDs at the checkout stands everywhere, whereas back home everything's pretty much digital now. But it's pretty good here.
is there still like a Blockbuster Video there or no?
I think there's no more Blockbuster, but there's HMV, I think, is still kicking over here.
Oh, so. Shit. Wow. There you go.
Yeah.
What's the food like? Did you have to adjust to food life in Northern Ireland or no?
No, it's pretty good here. You know, they got some really good restaurants here. I actually like to do a lot of cooking at home, so that really doesn't change much. Mm-hmm. Belfast is kind of on the rise, so there's lots of new restaurants popping up, and it's been pretty good. Like you would think the diet and what you hear of the Irish diet is meat and potatoes and stews and pies and stuff like that, but they got everything here. It's pretty good.
Now, the Brexit thing is interesting to me because I always felt like as an American, you know, everywhere you go, someone's talking about Trump to the point where you're just like, I wish I could go somewhere without somebody talking about Trump. Is Brexit like that? Do you, everywhere you go in Belfast, is someone talking about Brexit?
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy about that. You know, that's obviously a huge deal. It's an absolutely huge deal, especially for the country, Northern Ireland, because of the whole border issue and stuff like that. So it's definitely news every day and kind of paying attention to what's going on. So
is that going to mess with you?
A whole hell of a lot about Trump too. So you can't escape that either.
So. I'm sure. Is that going to affect you at all? What the UK decides to do at all or no, as far as like either your livelihood or your citizenship or anything like that?
It's hard to tell exactly how that's going to work out, but I think most guys, that are imports, you got to get a visa anyway, so it shouldn't change too much. I think the biggest thing that everybody, at least here, is worried about as far as players is if a hard border was to come up, then there could be some potential safety issues with the new IRA making some
threats
and some threats and stuff like that. So,
right.
But right now, it's just kind of wait and see what's going to happen. So.
Mm-hmm.
From everything that we hear, there's not going to be no hard borders, so we should be good for now.
Cool. Your league is a fighting league. It's always been sort of there's been some physicality. It's a kind of a throwback old school league at times, and I know that's one of the reasons that you're an endearing player for them there and have gained some cult icon status with the way you play. What's it like being a big name on a team like Belfast? Are you recognized around town? Do you love the fact that you've got a group of fans that clearly dig the way that you play?
Yeah, I think Ulster rugby is the big thing in town, so we can slink around town without too many people noticing. But obviously, the diehard fans and everybody, they know who every guy is in town. But it's good. Like it's a lot of fun. It's a good city, and I think the league is changing like the rest of hockey is. It's getting more skilled, and there's less and less scraps every year. So, depending on what your cup of tea is, if you like that or don't like that, that's kind of just the way I think hockey in general is going in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that you fought your way into the league when you started? Because I remember back, like, looking through your stats in Red Deer, I mean, you were like a 200 penalty minute guy, and I know back at that point you could, you know, maybe jump up a few levels if you were willing to fight. Do you feel like you were one of those guys that benefited from fighting being in vogue back then, you know, two decades ago?
Well, for sure. I think the way the skill of the game is now, if it was like that when I was playing, I wouldn't have had a sniff. You know, I think my last couple years of junior, I worked on my skill and I got some power play time and stuff like that and developed into a decent player. But, it was old school rules before the lockout there in 01, 02, and 03 and 04. So, that was still a huge part of it. There was clutching and grabbing and hook and holding and cross checking in front. So I think a lot of fights just kind of happen that way. But, I was always that type of player to, take care of the guys, and if guys were, crossing a line, I was always right there to back the boys up.
Yeah. Do you miss that? I mean, like I'm 40 something. I grew up watching the Patrick Division and, watching the Devils and Flyers and Rangers all beat the shit out of each other in the 1980s. And like, I understand where the game is now, and I understand it's a different game, and I understand why it's a different game, but there's always going to be a part of me that's like, the pinnacle of my hockey fandom was watching a product where there were fights and there was more brutality and physicality than what we have today. And there's always gonna be a part of me that will be nostalgic for that. Are you kind of the same way, or do you think that the game has evolved to a better place?
Yeah, I think I'm right on board with you there. Like, I think the skill level that's in the game right now is amazing, and it's great, and I love seeing that. The part that I don't is, if guys make a big hit or do a dirty play or something like that, and the guy goes to step up, and then he's, immediately penalized and suspended and all that. Like, which, obviously bad hits deserve suspension, but, if you're crossing a line, you got to step up to the plate. So, I definitely miss that part of the game. Mm-hmm. Obviously, like you said, it helped me make a really good living doing it. I definitely don't miss getting punched in the head like I did back then. I'm definitely miss some of that part of the game for sure.
All right, let's take a little trip down memory lane here. You had an incredibly eclectic group of teams that you played for in the National Hockey League. You were with the Flyers. Roenick's there, Primo's there, Leclerc's there, Brashear is there, Hitchcock's your coach. What was it like being with that crew? You got any stories from your days playing in the orange and black with Jeremy Roenick?
Oh, that was unbelievable. I think I'd watched one NHL game live before I actually played a preseason game for them. So,
wow.
Like you said, that list of guys that you listed off, Roenick, Recchi, Primo, Kimmy Johnson, Eric Desjardins.
Oh yeah.
Those guys were unbelievable. They were such great human beings and welcoming guys. So they just, made it seamless and really easy to come into that room. So, I didn't know what to expect, and, they were great.
What was Hitch like back then?
Oh, he was great. He's the type of coach that I really liked. Like, he yelled a lot and stuff, but I think he held guys accountable, and, I really liked the system that he had in place. And, I guess I've known him for a long time, and I have nothing but respect for him, but he was great.
You were in Philly for a couple of years, and then you had a stint again later on. is that just the kind of team where as soon as you put on that jersey and you're the kind of player that you were, that you feel like you're at home?
It was like, that's, you know, that's the team. They always like to have a couple guys like that on the team, especially at that point in time. You know, I think we had in the minors, we had two full lines of guys that every guy was willing to go to bat for each other. And, it was a lot of fun. I ended up playing with my oldest brother and with the Phantoms there. And it was just an awesome time.
Mm-hmm. You were at the Blackhawks for a few years before and after the lockout, and you were there with like baby Jonathan Toews and baby Patrick Kane. Did you like when you're there and you see these guys and you see, you know, I think maybe Sharp was there too, or a couple of those guys. Like, did you ever think, oh yeah, fuck, these guys are going to win three cups? Like, was there a notion that they were on that track at that point when you were there, or not yet?
Well, I don't know what their numbers were exactly their first year, but like you said, baby Kane and Dave, they were kids, you know, and they look like it. But you know, I think even at that age, their skill level was unreal, and you could see that they were something special. But you know, it's obviously to see what they've done in their careers, the way it's gone, they've done a great job. Mm-hmm. I'm just kind of pissed off. I missed out on that first cup. I ended up getting traded the year before, but
yeah,
you know, that's the way it goes. And they ended up beating us out. I can't remember exactly the year. They all kind of blend together, but I think I might have been Calgary the year they beat us out. But no, it's awesome. Like Duncan Keith and Seabrook too. They played both my D partners for a while there too. So.
Oh yeah, it's all right there in front of you. Yeah, you must be looking around saying like, ah, fuck, just keep me here for just two more years because they're going to win something.
Yeah, I'll be the water boy for the next year to win a cup with them. But,
hey, but when you went to Calgary, you were there with Keenan, right?
Yeah.
What was that like?
He was awesome. He was my type of coach. And he was quite calmed down by that point, you know, from the stories that you hear. But no, he was great. I ended up playing a little bit of forward there. The team was playing like crap. He would toss me up on forward and get me to go stir things up a bit. So it was definitely interesting. Had some fun there too. So it was good.
That's awesome. And the other one I wanted to ask you about, because you were maybe one of the only guys that could say that they were there in Chicago when the Kane and Toews teams, were kind of coming together. And you were also at Edmonton when Hall and Eberle and those guys were there. And I got to imagine that if you're on that team and you're looking at that talent, you're thinking to yourself, okay, this is probably like Chicago. Like, these guys are on track to do something special. And that group just couldn't do it.
Yeah, it's one of those things. Sport is really strange like that. Like, you look at the guys they draft, the guys they bring in, and even when Pitt was doing the same thing with all the guys they were doing, it looks like they're doing all the right things. And you know, if I had the answers, I'd have a better job than I have right now. But for whatever reason, it hasn't worked out in Edmonton yet. But you know, I grew up an Oilers fan, so I'm hoping they can get it together and get back to their glory days.
Yeah, and you did the Sharks, did the Wolves, and you went over to Switzerland. When you were in the Swiss League, were you angling to try to come back to the NHL at that point, or did you think that, okay, this is the next phase? I'm going to be an international guy now.
Yeah, I think, you know, I signed with Vancouver right after lockout, and it was a half year, and I thought I would get at least a handful of games up, but that didn't work out. And just talking to all the teams and kind of where they had me pegged in their lineups and stuff like that, I would have been a more veteran player in the American League. And you know, I could kind of see where that was going if I was going to end up scrapping a whole hell of a lot more.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not sure, but you know, I think at that point I had got away lucky by not getting my head knocked off for fighting as much as I did. So I figured we'll play a skill game over here for a while and see how that goes. So it's been great, and that was kind of the plan all along. Once the NHL kind of ran its course, I was gonna travel a bit, and not that I didn't enjoy it. I definitely did, but try to really get back to enjoying the game and turn around a bit.
Yeah. All right. A couple more real quick. Hockey in the UK. Where are we at right now? I mean, I feel like globally the NHL is sort of, you know, been on the rise. Is the NHL as a product something that in the UK is on the uptick, or is it still sort of very much a niche sport for the people that follow it?
I think it's kind of a niche thing. I think, you know, with soccer and, well, I should say football over here, but rugby and soccer and sports like that are so big over here. I think it's tough. Like, I think people that are into hockey and stuff, they love it, and they'll stay up late and watch all the NHL games and stuff like that. But yeah, I think it's got a ways to go still. You know, they gotta they gotta grow it from grassroots level here, and I think it's not quite there yet. But hopefully, you know, it keeps growing and growing, and we have, you know, make this league even better than what it is here.
Do you think that if the NHL went there more and put more games in London or you know, or whatever, that it would help bolster that, or does it need to be a grassroots thing versus having the NHL come in and, you know, parachute in for a weekend?
Well, I think it would definitely help for people to get a little bit up close and personal on it, because it's such a different game when you watch it live than when you watch it on TV. Like, I was always a guy, you know, kind of, even when I was playing, it was hard for me to watch it on TV, because it's kind of, you're up top and it seems to slow it down quite a bit, and you're like, well, I can do that, I should make that play, I should do that, and then you're thrown in the mix and you're doing it, you're like, holy shit, this is coming at me fast. And, it's quite a bit different game, you know, eye level down the ice, than it is watching it from up top. So
yeah, for sure.
For people to watch it, if they get a chance to watch it live, it's a totally different experience than watching it on TV or on your computer.
And I guess finally, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about fans in the UK. I mean, these are people that have been trained in the soccer stadiums of Europe. I got to imagine that's a pretty amazing experience to play in front of what I would term hooligans.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's different. It's not quite like the soccer experience like you would think. Like a lot of other European leagues, you see some of the clips of the fans and they're standing chanting the whole game and stuff like that. I think for this league, I think it's they have like a section where they go nuts like that, and then the rest is kind of the same as what you'd see back home, I guess. Like, still really good, really energetic and stuff like that, but not like the hooligans they had in Switzerland, where they had, you know, a whole side or a whole end zone where they're just going absolutely crazy for the whole game. So it's been a pretty cool experience to see how different hockey fans in different countries, how they take the game in.
Yeah, yeah. We're all trying to be Latvia at the end of the day. We're all just trying to get there. We can't do it. They're drunk at 11 in the morning. Can't get there quite yet. All right, Jim, man, you're the man. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. All right, our thanks to Jim Vandermeer of the Belfast Giants of the Elite Ice Hockey League, not English Ice Hockey League. It's a common misconception, as you said. The Athletic, with whom Sean draws a check, had a their players poll in which all of the roughly 200 beat writers at the Athletic has asked roughly 200 players a number of questions for their players poll. It's like what the NHLPA does every few years, and the Athletic did it this time. Sidney Crosby, best overall player. Okay, great. Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Final, who do you want starting a goal? Carey Price. That's a dumb answer. Isn't it a dumb answer? Like what? Yeah. What?
But,
what?
But who would you want? Like, yeah. That's, there really isn't an obvious
Vasilevsky.
Yeah, maybe. But
Ray,
I mean,
Wilby?
I don't.
He seems like he recently had some success in the Stanley Cup.
Braden Holtby got like 6% of the vote. He was the fifth guy on the
list.
Insane. That's crazy.
Like I know he had a bad year last year in the regular season, but like he's been one of the best goalies in the league for what, 6, 7 years now?
Mm-hmm. No,
and I don't feel like any. Speaking of underrated guys, like I don't feel like Braden Holtby has ever gotten the credit he really deserves.
No, and the fact that
Braden Holtby wasn't the Capitals' starter heading into the playoffs last year, the year they won the Stanley Cup, like the fact that like Barry Trotz is universally the best coach in the league right now, and he looked at that team and was like, "Yeah, I don't think Braden Holtby is our guy."
That shows you how much random shit move by Trotz. Like he should have
Of course it was.
But that's the thing. I mean, even the guys who are the best or close to it are half the time don't know what they're doing.
So the only reason I swear to God, the only reason Price gets number one on these lists is because of the Olympics. And it's like, yeah, if nothing else, we know that if given the greatest team ever assembled in front of him, Carey Price can totally win a game seven. Most underrated player in the NHL, Alexander Park. We should stop asking these players this question because they don't. First of all, they can't conceive what's underrated because they're not the media. And then two, it's always, again, we always talk about this. It's one guy for like 5 years. And after you get to year three, he's not underrated anymore. And Alexander Barkov is the new Louis Erickson. Now, the guy who's actually on this list that I think I agree with is underrated is Giordano, to be quite honest with you. He came in fifth.
I was just going to say the same thing. Yeah. Because he hit 60 points in his 62nd game of the season last night. He's the fourth defenseman ever over the age of 35 to score 60 points. And this is obviously, it used to be pretty easy to score 60 points in a season. So the fact that he's doing it now when it's not so easy is very impressive. He should have won Norris already. Mm-hmm. He arguably should have two, and he should win it this year.
He's not going to win it this year.
Is he due?
I disagree. I think Brent Burns is going to win it this year, and I think that Giordano is going to be a finalist, and that's going to be his reward.
That sucks.
I think this will be. I think this is going to be the same sort of thing that, like, when Drew Doughty was due, except this guy actually is due, and he's not, like, 27.
Yeah, he's
or
having an
Doughty
amazing
was.
Like, season, yeah, too. That year, Doughty was – he was good, but I you could make an argument he wasn't one of the top five.
The most overrated player in the NHL, speaking of defensemen, P.K. Subban at 23%, Patrick Laine, 9%. Aaron Ekblad, 6%. Dion Phaneuf, 4%. Dion Phaneuf apparently still on these lists.
Yeah.
And Erik Karlsson, 4%. The P.K. Subban thing is totally attitudinal, right? The fact that he's super famous and stuff is why he's overrated?
Well, that, and I don't think he's having a particularly great for him year. Like, he's having a good year. He's a good defenseman, but he's not one of the top 10 defensemen in the league this year, probably.
But yeah, you're right. This is like the he gets too much attention.
Yeah, he has a TV show.
And he's on the cover of the video game and all of that. So I think that has as much to do with it as anything. And yeah, it's kind of, I don't know. I don't know if I should read anything into the fact that four of the five are defensemen. But I don't know.
I will say I do
love Dion Phaneuf being in there.
That Ekblad pull's not bad.
Yeah,
that Ekblad pull's not bad at all.
Yeah,
I don't disagree with that either. The Subban thing I think is interesting because I recall last year, like, not only did he have the stats, but then it was almost like he was underrated because the analytics community is like, no, you don't understand. He's actually like even better than the glamour stats are saying in making his case for the Norris Trophy. So it's funny that like the players see him as overrated and then the computer boys are all like, no, he's actually even better than you think. It's a weird dichotomy. Which coach, aside from your own, would you want to play for? John Cooper and Gerard Gallant tied at 23%. Barry Trotz only got 11. And that's not a surprise to me because the players know about Barry Trotz. Like, Trotz is great and he's getting results and the whole thing. But, like, every Capital that was on that team has told their buddies, like, ugh, fucking Barry.
You don't want to play for Barry.
Shed many tears. Yeah. It's funny that should happen. Which coach, aside from your own, would you not want to play for? John Tortorella, 30%. Ken Hitchcock, 27. Mike Babcock, 15. Randy Carlyle, 11. Guy Boucher, 3. I really thought the Babcock one would be higher, to be honest with you.
Yeah, well, I think Tortorella just runs away. But what's interesting is Tortorella also got votes in the top five for coach to play for, although it was only like 6%. But so he is apparently dividing the room. Whereas, I mean, Ken Hitchcock, I don't think we're going to have to worry about much longer. Watching that Leafs Oilers game, like, I thought that might be the game where, like, just Hitchcock just left halfway through the third period.
Just walks off the bench.
Like, especially, like, did you guys see the weird thing with him and McDavid, like, in the lead up to that game, how he was, like, really banging the drum that McDavid was just gonna, like, show up and just completely annihilate, like, he was gonna be, like, Gretzky in the 80s, and then McDavid just has one of his worst games of the year and doesn't do anything.
Well, you know, I think it didn't help that that was the Edmonton media being like, you remember Wayne Gretzky used to come in here?
But then he they didn't say the words McDavid. Like, it was more like, hey, you know, when you were, you know, growing up, do you remember when Gretzky used to come into Toronto and he was McDavid? And then
it's what we
just
call
went
legal
right into
profession
it.
Leading the witness, though.
Perhaps. Like. Yeah, maybe a little bit.
Mr. Trump never directed me to lie. He simply said, isn't this the truth? And then that's the same thing.
Sorry, I was watching the Michael Cohen thing the entire day.
That one, right.
Let's pause on the Oilers for a second. Ryan, I always love when you're on Twitter because you speak such truth. Was it Mike Kelly who was standing for Leon Draisaitl saying?
It was Mike, what the Avalanche do well leads to a 104 PDO, in my opinion, Kelly, saying that, you know, after the one really great goal Leon Draisaitl scored last night, which I believe was on the power play, but I might be wrong about that, he has proven definitively that he is a number one center, or like he's a great center on his own without
that he couldn't anchor his own line.
Which I think he's awesome. I love Leon Draisaitl, and of course all day I've had Oilers fans getting mad at me for saying this, but Connor McDavid has a primary assist on 24 of Draisaitl's 39 goals. He's gotten into the scoring on 47 of his 77 points. And, you know, I think he has, like, most of his goals are scored at 5-on-4 when he plays with McDavid. And so he, therefore, doesn't score without him. That having been said, obviously, like, the Oilers are terrible and they don't have any wings that they can put with Draisaitl or McDavid, quite frankly, which is why Draisaitl plays on that line. But the point is, he hasn't proven that he can anchor his own line. Like, the thing Mike Kelly said was, like, it was a narrative that exists somehow, and I can't understand it. It's like, it's because he plays, like, the vast majority of his minutes with Connor McDavid and does the vast majority of his scoring with him. That's why the narrative exists.
But wasn't the narrative at one point, like, it might have been even by our friends in the Edmonton media that, like, hey, it's okay if he can't anchor his own line. He's going to be the Curry to McDavid's Gretzky, and that's worth the money anyway. Like, wasn't that part of the story too at one point?
Yeah, no. Even if he, you know, doesn't ever become an elite number two, borderline number one center, well, geez, you know, he's still going to put up 100 points a year with McDavid, and that's true. Mm-hmm. He's on pace for 50 and 100. That you can't do better than that, really, in the NHL. It's two different arguments. Is Leon Draisaitl great? Yes. Is he able to score without McDavid? No.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what we're talking
Sean,
about.
Yes.
Sean, are you fascinated by how done the Oilers are right now?
I am, and I think I'm waiting for them to win like two games in a row so I can once again talk myself into them coming back into the playoff race, because I've been doing that consistently for 4 years now. They got a shot at finishing second last in the league. That would be pretty amazing. Oof. That would legitimately be I feel like even heading into this year where there wasn't much confidence in Chiarelli and there wasn't much confidence in, you know, we knew Tom McLellan was on thin ice, and like I feel like if you had painted the absolute worst case scenario, we're maybe even beyond that at this point. Like, would anyone have been able to convince you that they were gonna like not hit 75 points or something? Like, I mean, that's
It's, I saw this on Twitter this morning. Their last 32 games, they're on pace for like 55 points. If that was the full
season. It's great. Like, I think, like, do we agree that like Hitchcock is not going to stick around?
Of course,
he's going to bolt. So they're going to be on to coach number three and GM number three in a calendar year.
That he's not a miracle worker like he's portrayed to be? Like, this is now two stops where he's done fucking nothing. Like, the Dallas thing was a disaster. This is an even bigger disaster.
Two stops where, like, that Dallas team isn't any good either. Like, well, you know, he can only do so much. They were pretty good last year, and the goaltending
thing. But his whole thing was he's the fixer. He's like Winston Wolfe. Like, he goes in and cleans the blood out of the car. Like, that's the whole point of Ken Hitchcock's existence at this point in his career. And he had no discernible effect on either of those teams. Well, I mean, he had a good effect on Dallas's underlying numbers, but he didn't get him in the playoffs.
Right, but, like, is that his fault? Like, he made them better. The team just stinks. That Dallas roster is bad. And it was last year. And it's the same thing with this Oilers roster. Like, yeah, Leon Draisaitl, like, they don't have three top six wings on that team. They don't have two. So, you know, what's any coach supposed to do with that?
Well, that's it. Like, I mean, you know, they've gone through two pretty good coaches this year. Like, I think Todd McLellan's a good coach. I think Ken Hitchcock is, you know, has been a good coach. He's obviously towards the end of his career, but you know, he didn't forget everything on the plane on the way to Edmonton. So, man, there's a lot of work to be done here, and good luck to them because.
It was just funny because I wasn't watching that game like as it was happening, but I was following it on Twitter, obviously, and you know, Edmonton goes up 1-0 pretty early in the game, and everybody's like, "Bah, this is it!" Like they're gonna you know, use this as a jumping off point, and half an hour later, everybody in you know that I follow in Edmonton was like, "Season's over. This is it. We're done." Like, it was incredible. Right. They just came out of the first intermission, got destroyed, and everybody in my feed who's an Edmonton person was like, "I guess we'll just, you know, start planning for the draft lottery now."
Yeah,
If they end up with either Jack Hughes or Kaapo Kakko, I will eat cat shit. Mostly because I'll be eating cat shit out of like depression if that ends up happening.
Look who's
I'll be doing
to get
it anyway.
Job.
Yeah, no kidding.
Right, exactly. Were you gonna say, Sean?
I was just gonna say, like, I mean, that's the most demoralizing type of loss is when you get your butt kicked by a team that is clearly not even playing well that night. Like, the Leafs were bad.
Yeah. Yeah, they got outshot
much of that game,
18-6 in the first period or something.
Yeah,
like that. It was
and then the Leafs, and in a way, in a weird sort of way, that's also a bad type of game for the Leafs because they've had a few of those where they just sleepwalk through and then for 10 minutes they're like, fine, we'll try, and then they, you know, they light it up against a team like Edmonton or Buffalo or Montreal or whoever, and that's, you know, not gonna create good habits for when they have to play Tampa or somebody like that, and they can't get away with it. But yeah, that was rough. Like, it was like the Leafs just rolled out of bed and we're like, fine, we'll give you 10 minutes where we're actually gonna play hockey, and next thing you know, it's 6-1.
Yeah. One last player poll thing that's worth mentioning is, which team has the worst fans? The Panthers won it. The Coyotes were second. The Hurricanes were third. The Islanders were fifth. So you have four teams right there that don't necessarily draw all that well. Mm-hmm. And then sneaking in at number four is the Philadelphia Flyers.
See, it really seems like a lot of people interpreted that question two ways, right?
Uh-huh. Right. It's pretty great, though.
Yeah, that rules.
I do enjoy that. Before we get to Islanders Tavares stuff, I wanted to mention, we don't talk nearly enough baseball on this show because it's a hockey podcast, but we do talk about weird rules a lot. And I wanted to mention two things that my friend Jeff Passan talked about this week that baseball's considering, which might be old news to everybody who follows baseball, but I'm a Mets fan, so it's new to me. They were talking about a 3-batter minimum rule for pitchers, which would increase the pace and speed of a game and would end the carousel of relief pitchers that's become so commonplace late in games. Under the proposal, the league would be able to implement a rule where if a relief pitcher comes in, he has to face at least 3 hitters. What say you?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that sucks about baseball is you get into the 7th inning and you know you're going to see 4 more pitchers per team. right? Like you yeah. go
lefty,
you go
lefty, lefty, ready, lefty, ready,
loogies and roogies and all that. Like you know, like you can't
love those loogies.
Yeah, you can't. Like that sucks. That is definitely a bummer when you go to the ballpark. Or like, I don't watch baseball on TV anymore, but.
But isn't it part of the strategy though? Like isn't the whole the chess
that's
match
the
of,
thing they always say? Oh, you know, if they're the double switch, that's why the National League's so great, and you don't like the
tell me
designated
about it.
Hitter. Shut up! You know who thinks that's St. Louis Cardinals fans? Those are the yeah. only people who believe that.
I am a dyed-in-the-wool National League fan, and I don't like the designated hitter. What's wrong with that?
You don't have to like it, but, like, you don't also have to be like, and you know what's great is when the last, like, the way people complain about, oh, the last 3 minutes of a basketball game takes 45 minutes. The last two innings of a baseball game takes 4.5 hours. And but
well,
nobody
you know
in basketball is like, yeah, we actually love when they call 4 timeouts in 8 seconds or whatever.
You know what? Some of us like baseball to be chess, and people like you, idiots, you treat it like you're just jerking off. Like there's a poetry and an artistry to baseball, sir.
It's like that. My thing with baseball is like that Earl Weaver thing where he's like, you get some big fat guy up there, knock the ball out of the park, and you can't make any goddamn mistakes. Like that's what baseball is to me.
He was right. He had here's the thing that I find fascinating about this though is that and if people are listening to this, given that it's a hockey podcast, there might be people who aren't baseball fans and don't follow it. Like what's happening here is. Greg, you mentioned the strategy, and that's basically what it is the strategy of the game has evolved in a couple of ways, one being with the relief pitchers. They have figured out that, you know what, the best way to use your bullpen is just to bring these big guys in and just have them go throw 100% for one inning or less, and mm-hmm. it results in there's a lot more strikeouts. A lot fewer balls put in play, which from an entertainment perspective is not as entertaining. And then the other thing that is happening is that they're trying to deal with is this shift where they've kind of realized that the positioning of the players, if you do these extreme shifts, can make it a lot tougher for the hitters, which means less scoring, less offense,
putting your entire infield on one side and that kind of thing.
Exactly, like these radical shifts, like taking a strategy that had always been there in baseball of moving everybody a few steps over and like just radically doing it. Turns out it works. Turns out it's a better strategy. But what's fascinating to me as a hockey fan is watching baseball. Like this has really been over the last few years that they've realized, wait a second, the strategy that makes the most sense is as far as winning baseball games leads to a less entertaining product. And that should sound familiar to hockey fans because it's a lot like what happened in the mid-90s with the trap and the clutch and grab and the eventually shot blocking and all of it and the butterfly and all this other stuff, which were very smart strategies that made your team better but made the product less interesting. And we all know what the NHL did for 20 years, which was nothing. Mm-hmm. They sat around and said, gosh, it would be nice if the game was more fun, and they made minor little tweaks and small changes that had no impact whatsoever. And partly because there was this appeal to tradition. You have to honor and respect the tradition of the game. And here you've got baseball, the only sport that has even more tradition and is even more in love with its own history than hockey. And it's taken only a couple of years.
That's quite
a claim. Like, yeah, exactly. And yet it's taken only a couple years and they're already like, yeah, you know what? We're not doing this. We have to make some changes. Even if it means going against history, we have to change because we're an entertainment product and watching our product get more boring, and sitting around for 20 years and not doing anything about it would be ridiculous and an abdication of leadership. And of course, NHL fans are sitting there going, yeah, we know exactly what that feels like.
Yeah. And, to further your point, like the other rule change they're considering is basically the shootout. They're talking about trying to do a thing where in extra innings you start with a runner on second base.
Yeah, so, instead of playing for actual regular season, or is that just something they want to do for spring training and the All-Star game because they want?
Well, that would
be
the trial balloon. Yeah,
like they would test it. Yeah,
and so like the thing with that for me is like if we're gonna make it like the shootout, make it like the shootout. The vast majority of games that go to extra innings. And in the 10th inning. So, like, this is addressing a problem that doesn't necessarily really exist.
Right.
You know, if you're worried about it, after you get past the 10th inning, sure, like have a guy start on second in the 11th inning.
Right.
But you're not – like the only thing you're really worried about, I guess, is one of those games that goes like 16 innings.
Right, and then that screws up your entire – I mean, your bullpen and your shortstop.
I dig the idea of it being like you implement it in like the 13th inning or something like that. But I agree with you, and I think the other problem is that like – you know, the shootout is what it is in hockey, but in baseball, like, if you do this, if you put a guy on second base, like, doesn't that just basically mean the first guy up's going to bunt, and then the next guy's going to try to hit a fly ball? Like, it would seem to narrow the possibilities of how a game might end dramatically if you put a guy on second base.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if they end up doing that later, like, if it becomes your way to not have games go 18 innings and, you know, end at 3 in the morning with 400 fans still sitting in the stands. Like I can get why you would not necessarily want to have those happen, but I'd be surprised if they started doing it right in the 10th inning. Cause that, you're right. The vast majority of games don't need that. But again, you know, the fact that they're doing this, and there are certainly a lot of baseball fans who are, you know, complaining or don't like the ideas and appealing to tradition. But the idea that the entire league has to just sit and make no changes at all of any significance because of tradition and watch the entertainment value of their product plummet is ridiculous to baseball fans and to baseball, you know, leadership as well it should be. But it wasn't ridiculous to hockey.
Right. Speaking of 400 fans in the stands, John Tavares came back to Nassau Coliseum this week to play the Islanders.
Yes.
Let's first talk about this video in which Islanders fans lament the fact that Tavares left.
For 9 years, you were part of the New York Islanders, and many of those years, you were the captain.
You were seen as the face of the franchise, the savior. You were the chosen one.
We looked up to you. Kids looked up to you.
You were not just only the Islanders' captain. You were the fans' captain, too.
We thought you were a class act, but looks like it was just all an act.
Do you remember saying that you loved Long Island?
I've always stayed at home, which I love it here.
Do you remember saying how great players stay with their team their whole careers and how you wanted to do the same?
This is obviously where I hope to be, and I've always stated that.
You went from being the captain, the savior, the chosen one, to a lying
traitor,
snake, pajama boy.
Okay, now this video was ridiculous.
We're all like, we don't want to.
And stupid. It was squirmy and awkward and very much like I once dated a pretty girl and now she doesn't talk to me anymore kind of thing.
They actually do the Star Wars dialogue at one point about how you were supposed to be the chosen one. Like. I saw this thing came into my Twitter feed like 30 times before I actually watched it, because I don't like watching like cringy stuff. And I was finally like, all right, I got to watch because it can't possibly be that bad. And it was so much worse than I thought. Like it could not convey how awful it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was like it reminded me of like a video someone would shoot if like a factory left their town. You know, we got nothing left. You were the only reason that there is a town. It was very depressing. Yeah. It was a very depressing video in a lot of ways.
When the first clip came, because there was like a 40-second clip and then it was a longer version. Like when that came out, like I think a lot of people had the same thought, which was that there had to be a punchline here, or that this was going to be revealed to be
right, like it was Borat stuff, right?
Yeah, like, or like some viral marketing thing, and we're all going to get like, But it wasn't, and it was like so. We should be clear. It was apparently some local news, and very local news.
12,
that decided to put this together, and I guess thought it was good. And you know, my only thing is, the video is awful. It's like five Islander fans, and you know, again as the member of a fan base who just had somebody eat cat crap. just, you know, you can't judge a fan base by the worst or dumbest or most pathetic of them, because nobody's going to hold up really well with that. And I'm interested to see what they're like. This is, you know, by the time some people hear this, the Islanders game will have happened tonight, and you know, we'll know what the reaction was. And I want to kind of, I'm hedging my bets a little bit, because there's a part of me that's worried that like someone's going to throw like a urine bomb onto the ice, and you know, and it's going to be a total debacle. But I've said this, I've written it. I think Islander fans are allowed to be pissed off at how things went down, even if they're wrong. I think they're allowed to be wrong. Yeah. It's kind of like when somebody breaks up with you, they have a right to break up with you, but that doesn't mean you can't go a little bit crazy about it and react to it poorly and listen to crappy music and make terrible videos in the parking lot of your local news station. So, I've kind of got Islander fans' backs on this a little bit, even though I don't think John Tavares did anything wrong. But he doesn't have to do something wrong for them to be pissed off at him. That's part of the deal we make when we become fans.
The thing that blew my mind about this is in looking at the replies to whoever posted the video initially, I didn't realize this because they all call him Johnny Pajamas now.
Yes.
There's right. No pajamas visible in that photo.
Dude, I wrote that last week. Islander fans are mad at me. They call it because they have been calling him Pajama Boy, and I said that it's Bedsheet Boy. Like, come on, man, you gotta gonna be traumatized by something, you gotta get the details. And I got a lot of Islander fans mad at me because apparently in his Players Tribune piece, and we all know how legitimate and personal those are. He makes reference to himself as Pajama Boy, but he's doing it in response to Islander fans already calling him that.
In jest, yeah, right, yeah.
Yeah, he's sort of like, all right, you're all calling me Pajama Boy, but it's,
But that for me was like finding out that you don't actually see anybody get murdered in Psycho. And it's all the implication on the screen.
It's their Berenstain Bears situation of like, no, he's That's in the right, pajamas, yeah. I swear.
The Nelson Mandela effect, but...
Yeah,
Nelson
we're doing the show on Thursday. The game is tonight, obviously, so we expect it to be a little chaotic on the island and stuff, and that'll be fun. I agree with Sean. Like, get your yayas out, give them hell, put Tavares stickers in the urinals, like do whatever you need to do, and then we just all move on. But you deserve to get your moment of angst because he did, kind of play along with the idea that he was going to be an Islander through the trade deadline. All the way through to July, and I feel like enough was said on his part to make you feel like he was coming back that you can be pissed off about it. It's not simply just I'm on the fence.
There was a chance he was going to stick around there. Like anybody who thought that was kind of deluding themselves. I felt like,
He thought that.
What?
He thought that. He said it. He literally said that. I at the time of the trade deadline, there was nothing. There was no thought in my mind that I was going to leave the team. Like he's literally said that.
I can't believe like that's an impossibility to me that's actually true.
All right.
I think that's PR from the pajama boy's mouth, though. Yeah. There's two things here. First of all, one take I don't like from Islander fans is this idea that he was always going to Toronto and he'd always had his mind made up from the very beginning. Because even if he didn't do this week long free agency bidding process just to waste everyone's time. Like he didn't drag the Dallas Stars out to come and pitch to him because he had already made his mind up and he was just trying to cover. And play with the emotions of Islanders fans. Like I think the simplest explanation here is probably the right one, which is that he legitimately was conflicted. He didn't know what he was going to do until he made the final decision. And some of the feel good PR around the whole the bed sheets and this is my childhood dream. I think backfired a little bit because I don't think there was as much to that as maybe it was made out to be. And in an attempt to sell a nice story to one market. You ended up maybe sending a bad message to another. But I'll say this, and again, I fully, if you're an Islander fan and you're pissed off at John Tavares, good. I have no issue with that. The one part I don't like is this idea that, if he had just done it differently, it would have been okay. If he had just said, I don't want to stay here, so trade me. Like if he had asked to be traded at the trade deadline, that would be okay. No, it wouldn't have been okay because then they would have said that he quit on the team in the middle of a playoff race. And if he had done it in the offseason, in the 2017 offseason, that wouldn't have been okay because then they would have said he walked out before he'd even finished his contract and he didn't even give them a chance to pitch to him. He didn't even give him a chance to sign him. So whatever he did, You know, there's no good way to get broken up with. Whatever he did was going to be the wrong way to do it. There was no right way for him to handle it. Islander fans would be pissed off and would have retconned a narrative to be pissed off at him no matter what he had done. And that's fine. That's, you know, ultimately that's, you're supposed to be a little bit weird and crazy about this stuff. And I don't mind Islander fans are. I just want to make the point that I think the rest of us aren't necessarily buying what they're selling when they say that if he had done it differently, that would have been totally fine with them, because it wouldn't have been and it shouldn't have been.
All right. We asked you, the Puck Soup listeners, to tell us who the biggest traitors in your franchise's histories are. We begin where we often begin. The biggest traitor, according to the Glory of 67, is Harold Ballard. Peyton Turnage writes in, Ryan Suter, or honorable mention, Jordan Tootooth for signing with Detroit.
I think both of those are crazy, by the way.
They are a little crazy. The Detroit national rivalry, though, I remembered that I totally very missed that. Gav writes in, Max Talbot blocked me for calling him Judas long enough after he signed with the Flyers. But Max Talbot, to me, is something that somebody
that's a good Penguins fan.
Yeah. You like that one?
Yeah, because he was like a beloved Penguin who went to their direct rival. Like, that's as heel turn a move Tritorious. As you can make.
Yeah. John Fisher said Ilya Kovalchuk literally retired at the peak of his contract to go play in the cozy, friendly, soft environment of the SKA St. Petersburg instead of playing in the best league in the world. Kovalchuk, the Q for quitter, is silent. But at the same time, Ken Smith writes in and says most Devil fans will say Parise or Kovalchuk, but it's definitely Scott Gomez going straight to the New York Rangers is the ultimate act of betrayal. He made peace years later, but still... That's a very good point, man. Yeah. Like, Kovalchuk goes to Russia, but fucking Gomez goes to the Rangers.
100%.
Yep.
Coach Jen says, despite now being a Blackhawks ambassador, Chris Chelios tops my list after going to Detroit and winning them the cup instead of us. Is that a sign? Did he sign there?
No, he was traded there. Yeah, that was, and they got a couple of firsts for him. So that was, I don't know about that one.
I mean, you can still not like it, though, right? Like, losing your favorite player to your big rival.
But I don't think, like, he didn't... It's not like he... It wasn't like a Danny Heatley thing where he was like, get me out of here, and then...
Yeah, you sold out, like ECW. Jay Trav writes in, Matt Niskanen, questionable headshot to sit after leaving for the Caps. Thought about Talbot, two cup goals, immediately goes to Philly, but we weren't going to pay what they did, so I can't hate on that. I'm sure there's someone even further back. I'm not trying to think that hard. We don't require you to think very hard in this show. That's fine. Let's see here. A lot of people say Ryan Suter from the Predators. That's very interesting to me. Mark McConville, my childhood team was the North Stars, so it's got to be Norm Green. But now
I'm
an LA Kings fan, so everything is cool there. Ethan McGarvey, this is interesting. For many Anaheim fans, the answer would be Korea. After his Hall of Fame induction and retirement ceremony, though, I think he's been forgotten. I don't recall Ducks fans being like Korea as a traitor. That's interesting.
Well,
oh, yeah.
They liked him as a player, but that was a weird – like he turned down $10 million, said that wasn't enough money, and then went and signed somewhere else for like
– Colorado, right?
For like a million. Yeah, like it was a real –
with Solani. With that's Solani.
A real weird situation. Yeah. So I
remember when Solani was a shark? Healed,
yep.
I think about that sometimes. I barely, like, I know that happened. I have no recollection.
But yeah, the Korean Solani combo to Colorado is like the, got to be up there in the all time, let's just pretend this never happened and never speak of it again situations. Sure. Like, that's right up there with like Messier in Vancouver. You're just like, let's not ever
talk. How about Sundin in Vancouver? Sorry, Sean.
Oh,
That's up there. I mean, that's one I'm surprised. Like, you talk about bad. Like, that's another one where there are bad feelings that are now, you know, have been papered over, and he's welcome back. Mm-hmm. But to, you know, that's the reverse Tavares, right? To not go when you're wanted to go.
When everybody wants you to,
And also, you know, not just you not going, but to then, because of who you are, prevent it, four other players from going. And then to say, the reason I didn't go is because I want to retire here. And also, I don't want to be a mid-season addition. And then you sign with a different team midway through the next season. That was a pretty good one.
Jonathan Sharman, speaking of the Canucks, says, as a Canucks fan, it should be obvious, Elias Pettersson in 5 years. Just kidding, it's still Messier. And then finally...
I love that Messier is a traitor because he went there. Like they hate Mark Messier for signing there and being like, I will become your new captain and your best player. And they're like, you bastard. You absolute bastard.
And then finally, Ryan Classic, our good friend, writes in, the donated liver that saved Eugene Melnyk's life is a traitor. Oof. So that's always good to get that in.
That got dark.
All right. That's the show for this week. Our thanks to Jim Vandermeer for joining us. Some personal news, which is something that people say when they get fired or leaving their job, but I am not. I'm moving to California with Ruby. Ruby got a job at Apple. I am currently, if you hear it and it's kind of echoey and shitty audio-wise, it's because I am in a vacated apartment in Manhattan. They moved all of our stuff into boxes. We've been sleeping on an air mattress. It sucks. But farewell to the great city of New York for your boy and for his lovely wife and for sneakers. This has been the best time ever living here for the last 5 years. And now off to San Jose, California. Campbell, to be exact. Where I will be eating burritos with fries on them and going and getting to know Logan Couture in perpetuity. So that should be fun, I think. Probably will be fun.
Should be.
Ryan?
Bye!
I don't know.
Sean?
Yes. I will also say goodbye, and I will plug my piece this week over at The Athletic. We are handing out the... what we're calling the Shirelli Cup, which is we're trying to figure out what GM could build the best starting lineup of players they traded away. And it turns out it's not Peter Shirelli, but I'll leave it to people to check that out and figure out who the top contenders are.
Oh, yeah, as long as we're doing plugs, sign up for the newsletter, sign up for Patreon, yes. All that kind of stuff. It's good.
That's... All right, newsletter, please. Mailbag coming up on Patreon as well. All right, everybody, thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Sticks and hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to an NFL commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Part 2.